Well, good morning. It is just about 11:01. You're listening to listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Saldatna. I'm Jay Barrett. Thank you, Jenny, for the excerpts from all the wonderful shows that we air here on public radio. We have a schedule change, and I know it's going to disappoint at least one person, but I'll make sure that they get to hear it on tape. But in the studio, live with me, is Mayor John Williams. John, why don't you pull that microphone a little closer to you there? You're right on time, a little bit early.
Well, there may have been a miscommunication on the time, but you know, you get started early in the morning and things work out better.
Yeah, there you go. Well, thank you very much for coming in. I really appreciate it. You know, this I pitched this idea to you as talking about you know, the state of the peninsula and Alaska and the changes that we've seen, maybe even the country. That you've seen over the past, oh, I guess 40 or 50 years, you've been involved as a participant and a driver of change and an observer as a mayor of both the city of Kenai and the borough of Kenai. You ran once for lieutenant governor. You've pretty much seen it all.
You know, when you talk about the longevity of the time, 40, 50 years, it's hard to believe that that much time has actually gone by. I first ran for the state legislature in 1966, and I was just looking over some old material yesterday. There was a news clipping as I was cleaning out a closet that I found pronouncing my assignment or my signing up to go to the legislature. And when you talk about changes, one of the profound changes to the structure of government here in Alaska came about, oh, I'm not sure just when, but it was after 1966. In those days, we ran at large in districts. And for example, in the Fairbanks district, we had 6 seats open, and you ran at large. If you were one of the 6 that won, you won. After that came the one-man, one-vote ruling by the United States Supreme Court, and it put Alaska into a category of having to district their votes, which profoundly changed the way politics was looked at in Alaska.
Huh, you know, that was pretty young. I didn't even know about that. Mm-hmm. Now, was that just for legislative districts? Because I know that...
No, that was for the whole country, actually. We all had to sign it. And as you know, we have right now 40 legislators and 20 senators, each running from their own district, the Senate districts being combined by 2 House districts and so forth. But that all came about long after statehood. We'd already organized the legislature and put things into perspective and then had to change the whole structure of government.
All right. You know, talking about legislative districts, there was a recent Supreme Court ruling, United States Supreme Court ruling, that struck down the districting in Texas for gerrymandering.
Yes, the magic word gerrymandering. I recall one time after quite a squabble over the way one party had gerrymandered the state to their favor, and the other party was heard to say, well, I'll tell you what, if you didn't like the way they did it, you surely wouldn't like the way we'd have done it. But, you know, one of the craziest cases of gerrymandering that I can remember in our local area was when they did the wraparound district from Nikiski around the hills and down into the backwater of Homer. You know, one weird district. And I asked the legislator at the time, I said, do you wear your cowboy boots on this end and your burkas on the other end? It was quite a joke at the time, the way it was put together.
I do remember that district. And then there was another one, another house district that went from, I'm going to say, the Bering Sea through the interior down to Yakutat, I think.
Oh, that was a tough one, especially, you know, those kinds of districts make it extremely hard on the legislator themselves to campaign in. It was really tough. It almost reminds me of the early days when we had the run at large process. We had to campaign from Chicken through Nenana and all the way up and down the Yukon River. And it was really, really tough because it was a lot of territory to fly. Everybody flew it all and everybody campaigned it all because you needed all the territory for your votes. But in a way, it simplified things, and it made it a lot better for the candidates. And I think it made it a lot better for the constituency, except for these really weird off-the-wall ones. I once said that one of the ways to probably do it so that it was the most fair, population-wise, was to start with a bullseye-type target. Put a little circle around your required population count right where it was heaviest. Continue to draw the circles of the bullseye until you got out. Your final district would occupy from Barrow to Juneau or Barrow to Hyder, actually, and you'd have constituents on each end. That would be true representation.
What do you think of Alaska's current legislative districts? It took several tries to get past the Supreme Court and the feds, actually.
Yeah, and I think that's the trouble they had down in Texas as well. You can always tinker with it. And even though it appears to be in balance right now, the truth of the matter is that the controlling party could restructure it in their favor and it wouldn't look at all like it looks today and would probably still muster through the courts. So,
you know, I should turn my mic on. It does seem though to are you saying that it balances out in the end, like over the years, over the decades?
Well, I don't know whether it does or not. I'll tell you, one party, the Republican Party, if we might as well go into name calling. The Republican Party versus the Democratic Party versus the Independent parties. I'll give them all equal time. At one time, the state was founded around the principles of the Democratic Party, and that carried forward until 1966. It was actually in 1966 that things began to change, and it changed with Wally Hickel. At that time, for example, in the Fairbanks district, we had 6 House seats, 4 Senate seats, a congressional seat, and 1 United States senator, and the governor all came up for election at the same time. And unequivocally, the Republican Party swept the district. They brought in Wally Hickel. They brought in all of the Republican. There was only one member of the Democratic Party won a House seat that year, and that was Tim Bradner, who later became Speaker of the House, as you may recall. But things began to shift dramatically. And, of course, when the oil was discovered on the North Slope and things really began to manifest themselves in a new economy, that's when the Republican Party really took over. Now, the Democrats did have some periods of time when they were in control, but very limited in comparison to the other side of the House. Sheffield, of course, was governor. Tony Knowles was governor. Cooper was governor, and all of them dealt with massive Republican groups within the House and Senate. So they were a mixed coalition. And we have to say, the mixed coalition of political figures, especially in Alaska, was pretty good for us. It worked pretty well. Not saying that today on the national scene, of course, but during those days of state politics, it worked pretty well.
You know, I have to agree. I noticed that when there was a coalition, a majority in the House or the Senate, I seem to think that things are less controversial. I remember when, my former senator, Gary Stevens from mm-hmm. Kodiak, when he was Senate president for, I think it was 6 years, couple of terms, it was a coalition of mm-hmm. Democrats and most of the Republicans. Things seemed to go pretty smoothly.
Right.
Though the oil people didn't like it because that's when the oil royalties changed.
Yeah. Well, you know, the change has been made several times in the taxing structure, but as long as the coalition consists of a majority of both members, and so that everybody kind of agrees that things should happen in this manner. The problem with today's politics, as I see it, And it's especially true on the national level, and it filters down to the local level, is that there is the far right and the far left. And the far right and the far left, I think, are the ones that you hear all of the noise from. You know, those that are not happy with either way. They're not happy with the way things are going. I've had an old saying that I've tried to operate by over the years. And that is, first of all, the only thing you'll ever see in the middle of the road is a double white line and a dead porcupine. And what I mean by that is that left or right, you have to move across that line back and forth, back and forth. And that's the way you get things done. Across the aisle, coalitions build themselves, partners build themselves, you need this, I need that, back and forth across that double white line. And that's what makes for good government. If you swing too far to the left or too far to the right, you're going to wind up in the ditch. And unfortunately, that's where government winds up a lot of the times, is in the ditch. So,
you know, and sadly, and this is a complaint I have with members of my profession, journalists, is that the people who are doing the shouting from the edge of the ditch are the ones who quite often have the best quotes and, you know, make the best sound bites on television and, you know, are the ones who get the press a lot.
Well, sometimes they're a little ragged, and sometimes the common guy on the street likes to hear a little ragged noise once in a while, you know. It makes for a better day.
Yeah, yeah. Have you seen that kind of partisanship over the years trickle down into local government?
Not really. I think my successful years in Kenai through both the Democratic and Republican control of the state legislature was the ability to forego partisan politics. Local government chairs, the councils and the mayors, were never supposed to operate in a partisan manner, although some have. You maintain your affiliations, but you work across the aisle. I see that both in the city and at the borough level. You may recall, of course, when I was elected borough mayor, I was probably the only Democrat that's been there besides Navarre in some time. You know, the rest were more Republican orientated, and yet we got along just fine. Regardless of the outcome of the election, I've always considered my years at the borough as very, very successful because we covered a magnitude of problems, and we solved a magnitude of problems, having, you know, had to do it the hard way. I always say the reason that I lost the second term at the borough is because we did the right things while we were there. Whenever you do that, always consistently looking at structuring so that it's proper, legal, well-funded, operating smoothly, you're going to ruffle a lot of feathers. So I do believe that we covered the territory in a very fair manner, and we did it with a nonpartisan group as well.
Mm-hmm. I guess it was just yesterday, we had on the Kenai Conversation two gentlemen who were on the city council while you were city mayor.
Oh.
Dwayne Bannock and Hal Smalley.
Mm-hmm.
They're running against each other, of course, for an assembly seat now.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, one is more conservative than the other.
Mm-hmm.
And they both sort of espouse those positions. Mr. Bannock, who I consider a friend, real nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he talked about, they talked about, one of the questions was the raising of the sales tax cap. Mm-hmm. That's coming up. For a vote on the election this year. And Mr. Bannock said that by doing that, it's tantamount to a thumbs up to keep spending, and that the borough's in a deficit situation, so we should hunker down.
Right. You know, the whole issue of the borough being in a deficit spending situation is not the fault of the mayor's office. It's really the fault of the assembly, because they're the ones that ultimately pass the budget. Now, when you get into a situation of budgeting, one needs to take a look at where the money is really spent. And this is always difficult with the borough. Since my term in office, I left 9 years ago, the budget for the school district has increased at the rate of $1 million a year. They're $9 million higher than it was prior. When you take a look at the mayor's office budget and the actual budget of the borough, it has not increased at the same percentage rate. And I do believe, if I have an actual count, there are fewer physical bodies working at the borough today than there was when I was there. And so it shows that overall, the central government itself is not expanding. What expands is the peripheral parts of government, the school district, no doubt by it, the service, fire service area. Think of the numbers of service areas that we have, senior citizen service area in Nikiski, road service area, borough-wide, fire service area, all these things, flood control basin areas. All of these things tend to expand in their budgetary process, but when you get the bill, it's all lumped together under one sign. It says, give me the money, you know. So it's a major thing to understand.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that with a dedication to keep funding for the schools going, other things suffer.
Well, they do and they don't. Generally speaking, we have better services today than we had 20 years ago. We have a good educational system, although I think the quality of education is tied a lot to the sign of the times more than it is anything else. What happens in the educational arena is people come up with new ideas on how to teach, and then you have to shift gears to make that work. Sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't, but it always costs money to try.
Has the borough been funding the school district to the cap, the limit?
Always to the cap. Now, I'm not sure this last time around if they actually made it to the cap or not. I recall one of the pitfalls that I fell into was a process where we were looking for every dime that we could squeeze out of the budget and take out of the budget because we didn't have it to spend. And I spotted lawn mowing money for the school districts. And I thought, you know, it'd be a great opportunity to cancel lawn mowing from about April through June, April, May, and June, one full quarter. You can get back on July 1 with the new budget, and we can save $65,000, $70,000 in lawn care money right there. Woe and behold, it came down on me with thunder and lightning that I had actually dropped below the cap. If I did that, if I took away that money, they were no longer funded to the cap, and that was an absolute sin. You cannot drop below the cap. So consequently, we shifted gears, and we traded off some legal services and one thing and another, and I got my $50,000 cut, but it didn't actually come out of the lawn mowing money.
Man. And then there's also funding outside the cap.
Yeah, the funding outside the cap is something that you come and ask for. You know, it's a specialty type of a situation. We really need a little money here, a little money there. Try something new on transportation or try something new on an experimental basis for teaching outside the cap. So,
how tough is it to govern or to oversee as a mayor in a boom town?
Oh, boy. It depends on when the boom comes and how it's approached. If you had the opportunity to plan ahead and begin to adjust things accordingly, fine. But if all of a sudden it just hits you overnight, it's a lot tougher. Here in Kenai, when it started out, I came here in 1968. I moved down here from Fairbanks, and very few of us were concerned about government that were not in it at the time. But there were a minute number of people that were, and they had to go to work and structure a government based on what they had in the past and what they hoped for in the future. And that was pretty tough. George Navarre, when he became mayor, they built schools. They had to build schools. That was the big thing. Cost a lot of money. Fortunately, they had a great bonding opportunity at the time because we had 30 years of revenue that we could see out in front of us from all the oil platforms and the manifesting with the way the taxes were structured. We had a 20 mil limit on how much we could charge the oil companies. We either charged it all or we charged portions of it. The trick there was to keep it in balance, because the way the law was written, you could go to 20 mils all right, but it meant you and I as citizens on the street had to pay that 20 mils as well. And I recall at one point a combination taxes between local government and the borough government hit 21 mills. In comparison to what it is today, it was double what it is today in the city of Kenai, for example. And that was tough. That was tough. The city of Kenai was broke. They were $800,000 in debt. They had a 21 mil tax rate, and we're struggling. We're just, you know, choking to death. And I remember going before the city council one night. Oh, this was back in the 70s. And I said, I wouldn't worry about the $800,000 debt. And I wouldn't worry about the 21 mil. And here's why. We're going to start building houses around here like crazy. We're going to start building more industry. You're going to see the economy blossom. And you're going to see your mill rate go down proportionately to that, because there will be more revenue sources. And I said, the other half of your $800,000 deficit is going to disappear in inflation. It's just going to throw it away. And if you recall those years later on, we went into mass inflationary periods there when savings accounts, for crying out loud, were drawing 10, 12, 14%. Interim construction loans at the bank were going for 16, 18, 20%. I mean, it was ungodly, but that wiped out half the debt right there. And then, of course, the growth period wiped out the other half of the debt. And as I said, when I left the city during a campaign speech one day, they were pitting me against the other candidate who professed to be more conservative. And I said, well, I don't know how much more conservative you could be. I said, I left the city with $35 million in cash. There was absolutely, in 18 years, I never floated a bond, and we only borrowed money one time, and that was under a guaranteed lease situation where we didn't even have to pay it back. The other guy paid it back. So I said, I don't know how much more conservative you could get. So everybody got a laugh out of that, and of course, I won the election. So.
Can I ask you... I wanted to go in one direction with this conversation, but I'm gonna take a turn here. We got maybe 5-6 minutes here. When I lived here before, it was during a time where you were pushing a lot of projects. There was the Challenger Learning Center,
Fire Training Center,
the Fire Training Center,
the Visitors Center, the Animal Control Shelter, on and on and on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I left for a dozen years. Mm-hmm. How have these things been going?
Well, they're all still there. They're all still in business. Some of them are being run by private enterprise. The Beacon, for example, took over the Fire Training Center and has been running it, I think, fairly successfully under leasing from the city. The Challenger Center has always been a challenge, as we knew it would be. It's a private educational institute. But the fortunate part about it is they have no debt. They have a beautiful facility, no debt. All they have to do is meet their overhead and payroll each year, and if they can do that, they can struggle through. And it's been a struggle for them. The Visitor's Center has combined itself with the Chamber of Commerce and thus cut down on their overhead costs considerably, and I think they're doing just fine as well. It goes without saying the Animal Control Center has been and always will be a success. You go by there any time, and it's always a joy for me to go by and see how well the animals are being taken care of. And then, of course, there's areas like the airport, it struggles on budget to budget, but it makes its budget, and it does have a healthy reserve account. So by and large, I think all of the projects that we fostered during those years has helped the city, and, of course, it's helped it maintain its economic balance as well.
Mm-hmm. I was impressed to see when I came back the Home Depot was still going well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that there had been a Lowe's, but it's shuttered now.
That was an unfortunate situation for Lowe's. Had they have asked me my opinion at the time, I would have voiced a no vote for Lowe's because the market isn't big enough. I think one of the mistakes made there was that they look at the entire peninsula as a drawing card for their market. That's not really true. So I think they lost out in that particular sense. And the other side may have been corporate greed, you do it, we're going to do it. So, but the Home Depot has a very interesting story sometime when we get a chance to spend a little time, how we converted from Kmart to Home Depot is a very interesting story. So
I recall when that happened. I remember the ribbon cutting.
Mm-hmm.
I remember at one Chamber of Commerce lunch, you got up and you talked about, well, you know what? It was after you had read Who Hid My Cheese.
Oh, yes.
And you were passing out those books. I think I still have my copy. But one of the things that you pointed out was, there is no place in the city of Kenai for a man to buy a pair of socks. Well, that's like the biggest Walmart I've ever seen in my life, right. Is right down here. And yeah. That must bring in some good revenue and people into town to shop.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Walmart has been a savior to the government here for ever since they've been here, just as Home Depot was, because more revenue comes in the form of the 3% sales tax, and that's what we live off of. But you're absolutely right. Until we got Walmart, you couldn't buy a pair of socks here. And it was unfortunate because I remember walking into Fred Meyer one time, and as I walked through the door of the grocery department, they had a large display of socks there that you could buy as you first walked in. So,
man, what do you see just staying in the city here? What do you see in your crystal ball for the city of Kenai?
Well, I see a slowing. I very definitely see a slowing, and I don't think that we're going to see a major boom of any sort. I think what you're going to see is the slowing is the new norm. I think we're going to have to come down and meet the economy at the level that it's going to settle itself at. We're going to have to be pleased with living in a small community with not a lot of major activity. There is only one point out there, and there may be others, that has always intrigued me, and that's the oil industry. The great rumors, the great stories of the Jurassic Zone, drill to the Jurassic Zone, 20,000 feet down, there's where the mother lode is. There's only been two wells that I know of that's been drilled into the Jurassic, and true to knife, there are samples and sums there, but we don't know what the extent is, or we don't know if all of the stories we hear is true. If that happens, you could then see a boom again. But short of that, I think we're going to go into slow is the new norm, and that's the way it's going to be.
Is the natural gas pipeline ever going to get built, and is it going to end here?
You know, the governor said yesterday, unless we can muster a new buyer who's willing to finance, this thing is going to have to be put on the shelf for some time to come.
Yeah, there's a glut out there in the world, isn't there?
Look at the price of natural gas in the lower 48. It's generally floating under $3. It's going to take at least $16 to build a pipeline. And there's no place in the world that $16 gas is being marketed now, and I don't even think for the foreseeable future. It's going to rock around $8 or $9 or $10 until at least the contracts presently in place are absorbed and dealt with.
John Williams, thank you very much for coming in.
It's been a real pleasure, and I want to welcome you back to the peninsula, too. It's good to have you back, Jay.
Well, thank you very much. I hope I can get you on the air more often.
Yeah, be glad to.
All right. Take care.